Accession number 10465, Reel 2.
Colonel Woodward, Reel 2.
The hospital was not relieved immediately because we had a very strict rule that any movement at night was enemy movement and automatically would have been fired upon. The West Yorks couldn't therefore go in, and it was left until the following morning, in spite of requests from the ADMS, but I gathered later that both General Masservi and Brigadier Evans, who was in charge of the defence of the box, agreed that there shouldn't be an exception to that rule. I didn't go in later into the hospital at all. There was no reason why I should have done, but certainly we heard all the shouting that was going on and the cries of the wounded, and sort of pleas for mercy and that type of thing. But the Japanese just continued to... sometimes they kept on calling out to in English to get the British troops to give away their positions, but that, of course, was not going on in the hospital area at that time.
So, whilst the massacre was going on, you knew that that was the case, did you?
Oh, it was yes. We certainly knew that it was the hospital was in being attacked. But there we couldn't go to the aid of the hospital because of the very strict standing instructions. Had we tried to move at all, there would have been we should have been fired upon by all our own people.
But presumably you didn't know they were massacring the wounded in their beds?
Not at that time, no. It was just the area of the hospital, and we knew that it was being attacked, that was all.
What was the feeling amongst the people in the admin box when it was discovered what they'd done?
Well, generally speaking, horror. And the next morning, when we had learned about it, and of course these things didn't get round very, very quickly, because we'd each attending to our own job, and there was no one to carry this particular information round. We'd each got jobs of our own to do, and we were getting on with them.
Is it possible for you to understand how such a thing could happen?
Knowing the Japanese, yes.
Could you be more specific?
They were... they certainly did not behave, say, as the Germans did in... the German army did in the various theatres of war. The Japanese were, we'd already known this from Malaya, we'd known it from Burma, the earlier battles in Burma, that if you became a prisoner of war, your fate was likely to be quite horrific. That they should do this to the prisoners in the MDS was well understood. In fact, I suppose it was expected.
What was the attitude of you and your brother officers towards the Japanese? Did you hate them or what?
We say yes, we certainly hated them.
Because of this type of thing?
Because of this type of thing, because of the... you felt that you were not fighting... as it were, people of the human race.
How did you yourself get out of the admin box?
Well, we didn't get out of the admin box. The admin box was held out from the 6th to the 24th of February, and 26 Div came down behind, and at this stage, on the 24th of February, it was how did the Japs get away back to where they'd come from? And most of them didn't. They were then cut off by our division, and we then resumed the attack on Butidong, which we'd started just before the Japs had cut down behind us.
I understand from talking to Brigadier Cree, who was a commanding officer of the West Yorks in the admin box, that you'd actually had a very narrow escape when the headquarters of the 7th Indian Division was overrun.
Yes, when the headquarters of 7th Div was overrun, that was on the 6th of February, at the very beginning of the box. We had been sitting down on the divisional headquarters area, and at 6 o'clock in the morning, the Japs came in with this, I think I mentioned before, with a full battalion, and our signals area was the first one to feel the attack. Unfortunately, in order to do the attack on Butidong, the defence battalion had been put back into one battalion. Normally, a defence battalion has one company out at each brigade headquarters, and the battalion less the three companies is normally at divisional headquarters for defence purposes. But this had been put back to do the attack on Butidong, which we were just about to start when the Japanese came round behind us. The divisional headquarters staff, we were in slit trenches, we got all our own slit trenches, but we had only pistols, Sten guns, and rifles, basically, and I think there were three VB guns, which is the Indian Army equivalent of the Bren gun. That was in the divisional headquarters itself. The signals obviously had a number of probably Bren guns, or they may have been VB guns, I'm not sure which. But we had no opportunity at all of taking on a full-scale attack from a Japanese battalion. We were fortunate in getting out of divisional headquarters in that the Japs didn't press home their attack. In the rear headquarters where I was, we stayed from 6 o'clock until about 12 o'clock, pooping off at the odd Jap that came along on the scene, and then a wounded BOR came in and said that the general had given the order to go at some time earlier at 10 o'clock, and everybody else had gone. So we then decided that it was time for us to go, and Captain Wood, the camp commandant, had done a recce the day before, and he knew the way out of divisional headquarters in the back area to up the Long Chong, and I knew the admin box, and of course we then got into the admin box 6 hours later by going through the jungle, making as little noise as we possibly could, and arriving there, I suppose, just before dark.
Can you tell me now about the work you did next after the admin box, going up to Kohima? Can you give me the details about that?
Well, when the division moved, I was always treated not as a liaison officer, but as an MTO, and wherever there was the nodal point for the movement of the division, I would be sent there with all the load tables and the various tables of dispatch, and set up a movement control headquarters. On this occasion, it was up to Durazari, where we were busy putting people into aeroplanes and flying them either to Imphal or to Dimapur. In the end, we had the division less one brigade went into Dimapur, and then went up the main Kohima road and did the attack on to the Japanese forces investing Kohima on the left flank of the 2nd British Division. The 89 Brigade went into Imphal, where they came under command of 5 Div, and they drove up to Ukrul, which was the place to which we were driving down from Kohima down the Jessamy track to Ukrul itself to clear the Japs there.
Did you see much of the state of the Japanese at Kohima as in comparison with the Arakan? Because one hears that they, certainly towards the end, they got in a very desperate state.
Towards the end, they were in incredible condition. They'd come, I mean, Kohima was a long way from their main area. They'd come up, I suppose, about 70 or 80 miles from their main area down on the Chindwin. And they had lost most of their supplies. They weren't getting supplies. And when we were driving down into Ukrul, you came across Japanese bodies in Japanese lorries. They just died, and whether they died from, they probably had gunshot wounds, but you didn't worry about that. You didn't. You left that to the you know, the people coming up behind.
Can you name any particular units that fought at in the Kohima Imphal area who you thought did a particularly good job?
I suppose probably the Queens, the first Queens, did a magnificent job there. They received a very large number of casualties, and eventually they were taken back to Shillong to recuperate, but they bore a very large brunt of the from our division. Two, Div, I wouldn't be able to say. The 4th, 14th Punjab in 114 Brigade were down the Jessamy track. Two Div had a number of, or great number of casualties on the main road going up, but we were on their left, and I didn't see very much of what went on there.
I think Jack Masters, in his book, one of his autobiographies, probably The Road to Mandalay, or whatever it's called.
Road Past Mandalay.
Says something like that the Japanese, most of the Japanese infantry, if they'd have been in our army, would have got VCs. Do you think that's a fair statement?
Oh, yes. I imagine that is probably correct, because they didn't care whether they were killed or not, and they seem to be quite prepared to accept death. In fact, down in Arakan, we had one occasion where the I think it was 19 Japanese gunners were completely surrounded on the top of a hill, and they couldn't get away, and they just walked off the edge of a precipice. So they accepted death, and they rather than surrender.
Was there a difference in approach between the Indian troops and the British troops in how they approach fighting? Did they have different qualities?
Yes, I suppose they did. The Indian troops were basically fighting in territory which was very like the ones that they lived in anyway. The British troops, it was entirely foreign territory. They were a long way from home, and I think the majority of British troops considered how soon they could get the trip back to Vilayati, or Britain, as the Indians would call it.
From what you've read about the campaign in Burma, particularly in the about the parts which you personally had first-hand experience of, would you say that the histories that have been written have been fair and accurate, or have you spotted inaccuracies which you'd like to mention?
Oh, I don't think I would have any comment on inaccuracies. I haven't been able to read for some little time, so in the last 10 years I haven't done any reading of the Japanese campaign in Burma. Um, I do have talking books for the blind, and the one thing that always has amused me in those has been the readers of those books have got the names, of course, entirely wrong because they don't know the pronunciation of them. So when you're listening to it, you just have to guess where those places are.
Yes, places like the Nyaki Dog Pass would cause quite a few problems.
No, yes, that caused one problem. But there was one, in more particular, there's a place called Abbottabad in the northwest frontier of India. One genius at one stage called it Abbottabad.
I think you were telling me earlier that you felt that you were talking about the performance of certain of the generals there, and you felt that at least one of the generals had not got his dues.
We had three generals with us in from 1943 to 45. The first was General Corbett, who had been chief of the general staff to Auchinleck in the Middle East. He came to us with the reputation of having failed in the Middle East. I think the majority of people within 7 Div would have turned around and said that he was a fine divisional commander. He trained the division extremely well. He was well liked by the troops, and they certainly understood him and liked him. Unfortunately, he left us just before we went down into Arakan.
And the other generals?
General Meservey, of course, came with an enormous reputation, and I first heard of his coming to command the division when I was, of all things, playing golf up at Gulmerg on leave before going down to Arakan. And we had a system there of drawing for partners, and I drew a Lieutenant Colonel Wood of the 17th Dogra Regiment, and as we walked down the first fairway, he turned to me and he said, "What unit was I with?" And I told him. And he said, "That's extraordinary. I've just come up from Delhi, and my former commander of 4th Indian Division, of which he was the G1, has just been made commander of your division." And so I said, "What was he like?" And so he said, "Well, he's an absolute fire eater. He'll either kill all of you or all the Japs. And for a long time you won't know which it's going to be." But we found him to be an absolutely magnificent general, and I don't think anybody felt really afraid when they were serving under him at all.
And who was the third?
The third one was General Evans. He'd been commandant at the Staff College, and he was meticulous to a degree in putting planning into operation, but he did the crossing of the Irrawaddy at from Michi to Niyango, which is near to Pagan, the capital of Burma, and the one which led to the 17 Div with the 255 tank brigade getting through and taking Mike Tiller, which at that time really wound up the Burmese campaign. He was a very thorough, meticulous general, and it was he who, when the first time he saw me, he said, "What staff college had I been to?" And I said I hadn't been to the staff college, and he said, "I always insist upon my second grade staff officers having been to the staff college." So I thought, well, having agreed with General Meservey to give up the staff college and come back and be DQ of 7 Div, I was now on a loser. However, within a month of that, I'd been made AQ because the AQ had gone sick.
Did you ever think that the Japanese might succeed at Kohima and Imphal in breaking into India?
Not at Kohima and Imphal, no. I didn't think that. At the beginning of the Arakan campaign, I think we probably thought they might. But in Kohima, we were well established there. We'd got two divisions. They couldn't ever get through us on that front. Imphal was bound to hold out. There were four good divisions in there, and it was merely a matter of time before they were worn down, and it was a complete defeat for the Japanese.
Can you give me some details about what happened to you after Kohima and Imphal?
Kohima and Imphal, yes, well, I went off on leave after the fighting had finished at Imphal, and the division was in rest until we started to go down the Gungor Valley, which was to do the crossing of the Irrawaddy. Here, the General Slim had decided to cross over 33 Corps and 4 Corps, which was a most extraordinary army manoeuvre, but this was in order to get the 4 Corps, commanded then by General Masservi, who had taken over from General Evans at Sevendib, and he'd taken over from General Schoons in 33 Corps, and General Evans had taken over Sevendib. And the idea was to get 4 Corps to go down the road from Mike Tiller to Rangoon in order to get there before the monsoon. So we were to get down and do the crossing without really disclosing that it was a divisional strength going down there. And to do this, we had the 28th East African Brigade, Independent Brigade, ahead of us, and we kept back until we arrived at the banks of the Irrawaddy, when we suddenly forced the crossing and got across onto the eastern bank.
What was the crossing like?
It was the longest opposed river crossing of any theatre of World War II. And to begin with, one battalion failed in their objective, but immediately afterwards the 415th Punjab were put across under Colonel Conroy, and they got ashore, and by the evening we got most of a brigade across.
Did you see much of the local inhabitants either at Kohima Imphal or later on in central Burma?
The local inhabitants in Kohima, yes, we saw the Nagas, quite a lot of them, and of course they had a wonderful reputation, and they never let down any of the British troops at all. You could rely on them completely, both for guides and for not telling the Japanese where you were, and there was a complete trust with them, and this was partly due to the deputy commissioner that was in Kohima. He seemed to have an extraordinary way with him and with the Naga people. In Burma, we didn't see very much of the Burmese people. There was a tendency when fighting was on, they were somewhere else.
I think the local people at Imphal are called Kukis. Did you come across them?
No, we didn't actually do any fighting in Imphal. We went down the back into Ukrul, and then we were pulled back to Kohima, and when we finally went on, we went straight through Imphal down to the Gungor Valley.
What happened to you after the Irrawaddy crossing?
We, as a division, then went down through along the Irrawaddy, down through Prome, and to cut off the Japanese coming out of the Arakan, which we did with great zest, as they were then a defeated force.
One hears that they were absolutely desperate at that time.
They were in appalling condition, and some of them did get across the main road into the Arakam Nyomas, which were the mountains on the other side of the Prome Road, and the British troops, we didn't bother to go after them, we just waited for them. They had to get out across the main Pigu Tongu Road, and we merely lined up there in what was termed the duck chute, and just to, as they came across the road, if they wouldn't surrender, they were shot. And of course they didn't surrender. They were quite determined to get back into Siam.
Did you ever see any Japanese prisoners?
Well, we saw Japanese prisoners. In fact, I can remember seeing the first one. He'd been incapacitated. He had his hands tied, I think, so that he couldn't commit suicide. But he was regarded as a very valuable piece of war equipment, if you like, the first time we got a Japanese prisoner. But later on, they began to come in increasing numbers.
How were the prisoners treated?
Always taking into account the fact that they would try and commit suicide, or you had to assume that they were going to commit suicide, they were treated very well.
Is it true that the Japanese, once captured, would say practically anything?
I was never involved in the intelligence side, nor did I question any Japanese prisoners.
Did you didn't go into Rangoon?
We went into Rangoon after it had been captured, yes. I suppose we visited Rangoon, but there was nothing very much to be seen there. And after the Japanese had surrendered, we were concentrated at Morbi, which is about 30 miles out of Rangoon, and our task then became to fly into Siam to disarm the Japanese in Siam.
Did the Burmese in places like Rangoon seem to be glad that the Japanese had gone and the British had come back, or were they anti-British?
I couldn't say anything to that at all. I don't know. I was not in Rangoon itself, apart from short visits down to the town, and there was no reaction at all from the local population.
Can you tell me about the reaction of you and your brother officers when you got the news that the war with Japan had finished with the atom bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima?
Well, I